This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, throw a towel over language because not every beach is a nudist beach. On with the show. What is the function of a dictionary?
Oh boy.
Sorry.
How many hours we got?
You wrote about 270 pages on it, so.
Right.
Corey Stamper is the author of the new book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries. Her regular job is writing dictionaries for Merriam-Webster, where she's been working since 1998.
So primarily, the function of a dictionary is to record as much of the language in use as it can, as that language is used, and not as we wish that language is used. So many people assume dictionaries function as gatekeepers of proper English, that they don't let wrong words in or ugly words in or bad words in, and that's just not true. Any word that's used in print is fair game for entry into a dictionary. So that's the first usually mind-blowing thing about dictionaries. The other is you're trying to gather as much of the language as possible. And that means that you're going for everything from historical uses all the way to modern slang. But you know you're not going to catch it all. You know you just can't catch it all. So you have to make some judgment calls and set some criteria for what's eligible for entry into certain dictionaries. So there are three main criteria that every entry in a Merriam-Webster dictionary, and frankly, most professionally edited dictionaries, has to meet. It has to have widespread use. We're looking at language that gets used across a wide variety of types of sources and geographical areas. So you're looking for a big spread of information. The second criteria is sustained usage. Because language is fluid, things come into use, written use, and then drop out of use. Or things are in spoken use for a very long time before they show up in written use. Or things have sporadic written use for a very long time. And because print dictionaries in particular space is at such a premium, you really need to think carefully about, all right, if I enter this word now, and it's in its first flush of use, and everyone's using it. On fleek, let's say I'm going to enter fleek.
Attributed to a 2014 Vine video by Chicago teenager Peaches Monroe, in which she declares her eyebrows to be on fleek.
Everyone's using on fleek. Is everyone going to be using on fleek in 5 years? Well, you can't know that. You know, we're not clairvoyant. So you want to have a body of sustained use that you can say, okay, looks like this has pretty much entered the language fully. And then the third criterion is it has to have a meaning. And that sounds ridiculous, but there are words that occasionally make it into print that are mostly examples of long words or examples of nonsense. And so those are not really eligible. You can't write a meaning for anti-disestablishmentarianism when all the evidence just shows it being used as an example of a long word.
What are the most difficult words to define?
The small ones. I defined the verb and the noun take for our collegiate dictionary. That took me quite a while.
How long?
That took me about a month, 3 weeks to a month.
And you managed not to set the whole thing on fire?
Yeah, just barely, though.
Well done.
There were some moments. I also worked on the entry for go and do for our learner's dictionary. A learner's dictionary is a dictionary for people who are learning English as a foreign language.
Let's take a moment to try to define do. Ah, it's infernal. I'm in a semantic maze and I keep getting spat back out at the beginning.
Yeah, the small words are always the hardest because their uses, their semantic uses, they're difficult to describe. And they're also they're just everywhere. I mean, it's just, you have no idea how many times you use go or do until you have to catalog all of the major ways that people use go or do. And there's slight differences. Like doing your laundry is different from doing dinner. If you say to someone, hey, let's do dinner, that's a different meaning than saying to someone, hey, let's do our laundry. Like that's, those are two different meanings of do, even though syntactically they look exactly the same. And those entries are huge. They're really long. The hard part about doing small words is it takes so much time and they're completely unappreciated. Nobody looks these words up. No one's going to look up as, but, you know, but it's your job. That's your job. You're going to accurately collect, define, and arrange as many of the words in the language as you can. And that includes as, and that includes go and do, even if nobody ever looks those words up.
You also have to write those definitions in a very precise way, using only words that appear in the dictionary, and exhibiting no opinion, no bias, as little character as possible. Boring. Basically, you have to write a dictionary to be boring.
Sometimes you want to make the dictionary sexy, but it's just not a sexy thing. So that's okay.
It's got rude words in it.
It does have rude words in it, but they're defined really unsexily. There's no oomph to any of the rude words. Alas, so it goes.
But it's deliberate, isn't it, that there is no oomph?
Absolutely. The dictionary shouldn't have narrative interest. And you really want, especially with profanity, you really want those definitions to be very clear, but you don't want them to detract from the other definitions around them. Nothing should really stand out in the dictionary as being more interesting or having more narrative interest than any other entry. So yeah, they're very deliberately boring. We do deliberately boring very well.
Why does it have to be boring?
That's a good question. What I've found is that people trust dispassionate, boring entries more than that same information given with some sort of narrative interest. Maybe people just assume that if something is presented blandly, it must be authoritative.
And dictionaries are seen as authoritative.
Because the dictionary is seen as an authority, and honestly, especially in the United States, that's a historical problem that dictionaries created. That's how we sold dictionaries in the 1800s, was to say that we knew everything and we were the authority. So because people see it as an authority, they also assume that it functions in the role of an authority. And authorities tend to set limits, keep some things on one side of a rule and other things on another side of a rule. People, because they see it as an authority, they assume that it's prescriptive, that it champions the best practices of English. And so they get their knickers in a knot then when they find entries for words like irregardless in dictionaries, because that's just wrong and ugly and stupid. Why would you enter that word? But it's because it's been used in print quite a bit.
That's the dictionary's job, to record how language is being used, irregardless of how we want it to be used. Yes, it hurt me to say irregardless even more than it hurt you to hear it. But if you spend any time with the dictionary, you see how the English language is riddled with words which don't make logical sense, that have substantially altered or even reversed their meanings over time, that logically shouldn't exist at all, but do, because people use them. So you can't expect the dictionary to present a perfect form of language, because language is imperfect. Moreover, you can't expect the dictionary to present your perfect form of language.
You get people who are angry that the word fold exists.
Fold?
Yes.
F-O-L-D?
F-O-L-D.
What's so offensive about that?
I don't know, but it's offensive enough that I have someone who emails me regularly asking me to remove it from the dictionary.
You can't get a word removed from the dictionary because you don't like it. Even if you don't like it for legitimate reasons.
A lot of times you will hear from people who will find a word that is now offensive but has significant historical use that's not offensive. The word that immediately comes to mind for me is retarded, which when it first entered was a medical term and was a medical term for a very long time and now is considered offensive. And people just want the word removed. Or they want you to say that the whole entry is offensive, when in fact, it's not quite that simple if you're giving a broad view of the language. And I think that's hard, especially when words hurt. People want the dictionary to swoop in and say, this word is terrible and no one should use it. And even if I feel that way, I still have to describe what the medical use of that word is, and I still have to describe what the offensive use of that word is, and I have to do that accurately. And that's painful. You're faced with the painful history of human reality when you write dictionaries.
And the present of human reality being enshrined in the dictionary is too painful for some.
So in 2003, Merriam-Webster put out a new edition of our dictionary, the Collegiate Dictionary. And in that dictionary, we included a subsense at the word marriage that covered the uses of marriage to refer to gay or same-sex marriage. And this went unnoticed for a number of years.
Until 2009.
A very conservative blogger had stumbled upon it, and he happened to have a radio show, and he encouraged his listeners to write in. They read the entry and felt that we were commenting on the thing, marriage, and not the word, marriage, because they felt that we were legislating from the book, and it just started snowballing from there.
When people contact Merriam-Webster, the lexicographers are obliged to respond to every message.
I got, I think it was, by the time it was said and done, it was something like 4,000 emails in a three-week span from people who were furious, absolutely furious that we had entered this, that we were telling them what marriage was. Noah Webster is turning in his grave. And so we spent time responding to people and saying, this is what the dictionary does. This is what this entry means. This use of marriage has been used by opponents of gay marriage and proponents of gay marriage. This is how everyone talks about this particular meaning. And it escalated. I received some death threats. I mean, not to me personally, but, you know, the company. And in that, too, we also heard from gay and lesbian and bisexual people who responded and said, thank you. This is important. Now I can show my parents or my friends or whoever that my relationship is valid in the eyes of the dictionary. So it was really fascinating and hard because, of course, people are responding to that entry as if the dictionary is an authority on life. And we're not. we handle words, and that's about all we can do, is just the words.
Corey Stamper's book, Word by Word, The Secret Life of Dictionaries, is out now, and it is a fantastically entertaining and informative account of how lexicography works, what dictionaries are for, and how language really functions. It is the perfect book for you lot. And yes, there is a whole chapter in defense of irregardless. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is remuage, noun, the periodic turning or shaking of bottled wine, especially champagne, to move sediment towards the cork. Try using it in an email today. If you're interested in the history of On Fleek, you can hear it in my other podcast, Answer Me This, episode 339. Personally, I have never been able to use it without quotation marks. Any slang coined in my lifetime, I feel too old to be allowed to use. The next episode of The Allusionist will be out on the 5th of May at theallusionist.org.